the link between God and government. And if you can't see that, if you don't realize that God blesses or judges a nation according to what that nation's stand or reflection is toward God, then you're going to miss out on a lot of history. And so I hope that more than just gaining information, you'll be learning what God had to say in the Bible about government. And our verse said, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." And this nation is not that nation. It is not that nation. But hopefully, if we can do this, and to be honest with you, my desire... Okay, nobody says anything about my drawing or whatever this morning. My desire is to try and teach a younger generation. And not many of that younger generation is in here this morning, but I can't begin to teach a younger generation without the help of parents and grandparents. And we have traditionally, for the last 75 to 80 years, allowed our children to go off to school and to be taught by people that we don't even know. And there we've allowed them to be taught things that we don't even check up on, and we have just assumed that everything was all right. And to be honest with you, everything is not all right. And a lot of parents are going to give account to God for not checking up on the education of their children. And, you know, there are different viewpoints on whether a child should be educated at home or whether they should be put in a Christian school or even whether they should be allowed in a private or public school. And that's not our point to argue those things. But no matter where your child is educated, as a parent, you owe it to your child to check up on what your child is learning. And we have always been intimidated by the thought that, well, you know, I don't know all this stuff. Well, shame on you. I mean, if you're ignorant, the worst kind of ignorant is proud ignorance. Proud ignorance becomes arrogancy. And if you're ignorant of the history of this nation, or if you're ignorant in how to spell, or if you're ignorant in how to speak English, you need to learn that for the sake of your children. This is not a day and age when we want better for our children. Matter of fact, the statistics that came out just within the last year stated that this generation is the first generation in the history of America that upon graduation from high school actually know less than their parents did when they graduated from high school. So if you're a parent right now of a small child, you know more than your child does if they just graduated from high school. Now they think they know a whole lot more. And I'm not talking about practical experience. That's always been true. Parents knew more practically than their children did when they graduated. But thank you. All right. There we go. However, if you compare the academics, your children academically are less than where you were when you graduated. And we point out the fact that back in 1962, the SAT scores were 80 points higher than they are right now. And, of course, the world has set out to find any kind of an excuse that they can find for that. I'm not interested in excuses. I want my children to be educated. I don't want to hear why things are different now and why, because we've become a multicultural society, we have to adapt to other cultures, and that's garbage. I want my child to know that 2 and 2 equals 4. And I don't care how many other cultures, you know, the problem, and we will address this hopefully in the last few sessions, we'll try to find some kind of a moral or an end to what we're teaching. But the idea is this: America, in order to adapt to all the cultures that are represented in this country, has lost its own culture of high standards in academics and morality. And that was never the intent of your forefathers. I'll give you some information on the separation of church and state and religious liberty, and both of those two things have been changed and destroyed from what the American forefathers wanted them to be. This nation was conceived as a Christian nation, with the Bible as its guidebook and the Bible moral values as the values that were to be in place for this nation. You say, well, how can we have religious liberty? Religious liberty merely allows anybody else that comes to practice their religion. It does not say that we don't have to have a religious liberty. Doesn't mean the absence of religion. And this nation was founded as a Christian nation. As a matter of fact, you will not find any other nation on the face of the earth that allows religious liberty save this one because of where it was founded. Yeah, it is the Christian people in this nation that came up with a concept of religious liberty, and the reason that a Mohammedan or a Jew or a Catholic or a Protestant is free to practice their religion unimpeded in this country is because this was a Christian nation. And now we've been taught that the reason everybody has problems is because this was a Christian nation and those big, mean, ugly Christians didn't allow anybody to have any liberty. You think that's true? Go to Iraq, try to start a Baptist church. Go to Italy, try to start a Baptist church. Go to Mexico and try to start some type of a Baptist church or Baptist school. Give it a shot. And you find out in a hurry that the reason this nation has religious freedom is because it was a Christian nation and it was dedicated to that idea. Now, that doesn't mean this nation didn't have a religious stance, you see. We were a Christian people. And we'll deal with those values as they came through. I've been reading John Locke this week. I've been spending a lot of time with old books. John Locke was a lawyer. And John Locke was a lawyer that was banished from England because of some of his viewpoints. But John Locke's great papers on toleration dealt with the separation of church and state. And I want you to be aware, when these men write about the separation of church and state, be it John Locke, be it Thomas Jefferson, be it George Washington, be it Benjamin Franklin, they were concerned with two churches. Number one, they were concerned that the government be separated from the papacy. Thomas Jefferson was just adamant about it. What Thomas Jefferson said, "I do not believe there would ever have been an infidel had there never been a priest." That's an exact quote from Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, as a matter of fact, stopped believing in the Trinity because he said it was an invention of the Catholic Church. And he was so opposed to the papacy that he renounced all ties to the Trinity. Now, I'm not going to go quite that far. I mean, if the Catholics tell the truth, bless God, they tell the truth. I can side with anybody who's telling the truth. But they did not want papacy established in this nation as a church state. Not only that, but they did not want the Puritan form of government or the Anglican form of government. You see, all the Anglicans were was an offshoot of a church state. The Anglicans controlled the government or were involved in the government in the nation of England. And when the settlers began to come to this country, you need to realize they didn't have anybody to follow after. And when they came to this country, they had no idea of how to establish a government. Sometimes we think, well, boy, they just came over here and elected a president, and that's the way. It didn't work that way, folks. There had never been a nation set up. This is the first in history established like this nation was established. There was no other nation with a division of powers on three levels. There was no other country that had a Supreme Court and had a congressional house there to make laws and an executive branch. There was nothing like that anywhere. They came from countries in Europe where they had a king or a monarch or a parliament or a priest or a prelate telling them how to run the government. They didn't have anything in this world like they established in America. And one of the things you need to bear in your mind as we come through here is these people are sitting down and on their faces before God trying to figure out what is going to be the best way to run this colony at first or this city at first. The settlement at first, and then expanding on to the colony and the state, and eventually the 13 colonies, and then the United States of America. It was an outgrowth of men that honestly desired a goal, but didn't know how to achieve it. They had no previous model from which to draw, and that's why you find that men like Charles Montesquieu and John Locke formed the opinions of these men, because those men were ahead of their time, and both of those men suffered because of their stand, which said that the system we have in England, the system we have in France, the system we have in Europe is wrong. And they went on to tell why it was wrong. They went on to tell why the church had no right to dictate over the affairs of the conscience. I'll read some of John Locke's writings to you, and it'll amaze you how much insight that man had. It'll amaze you what he could see as far as what happens when a church gains control of the government. He distinguished between the civil government and the spiritual government, and said that neither has a right to infringe on the other. And so those men were worried about two forms of government. They were worried about that Puritan form of government, which in this country really had just copied Anglicanism. You see, they didn't just come over here and establish democracy where everybody voted and we elected. It didn't happen that way. When they came to this country, they established a form of government where people arrived here and they copied what they had left. And they tried to straighten out some of the things that were wrong with it, but by and large, they kept what they had left England or what they had left Europe with. And in less than 50 years, you've got a mess. You've got a mess. Now, the map on the board this morning shows you really the birthplace of where this country actually originated. And although I'm not a good artist or anything like that, this will kind of show you Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. That's where this country basically came into existence. This little area right here on the coast where you'll find, see if I can get in here and point. That'll be good, right? I don't know which way to go. Right there is Plymouth. And Plymouth is where the first colony was established by the Pilgrims. Now, the distinction between the Pilgrims and the Puritans, I hope you remember it. What were the Pilgrims? Separatists. The Pilgrims were separatists. They had separated from the Anglican Church, lock, stock, and barrel. Remember, they said there's no way of saving or straightening out this mess. And so they said, we just separate with it totally and completely, and they were called separatists. They were very poor people. They were very, basically, were not very educated, and they just were common, ordinary people, but the one principle they held to was the separation of church and state. They believed what was in England was corrupt. When the Puritans came, the Puritans believed in doing what? They wanted to change from within. They wanted to change the Anglican system from within, weed out those corruptions that they knew existed, and formulate really something that was right. The problem was they were working with bad roots to start out with. So when the Puritans came to this country and established their colony, they established a colony that basically was set up like that they left in England. Number one, they established a colony where the first problem they ran into was, how are we going to run the churches? You see, in England and in the Anglican and also in the Roman Catholic and also in the Lutheran synods, and you'll find most every church is set up that way, there is a hierarchy, a religious hierarchy that oversees the church. They establish, sometimes it can go as far as establishing doctrine. That it can be that strong in papacy. When the Pope makes a decree ex cathedra, if you're not a Catholic that believes what the Pope says, you're damned according to church doctrine. I've heard people say, well, we just don't believe all the Pope says. Well, according to the writings of Augustine and according to the writings of Boniface, you're damned. Now, I don't know what they tell you now, but I understand Vatican II supposedly undid all that, but you'll never find one vote on Vatican II or Vatican I that rescinded all the teaching of the church prior to that. As a matter of fact, I can show you a quote where they said they kept all of it intact. So if they kept their doctrine intact, then you're damned this morning if you don't side with what the Pope teaches as doctrine. You say that's pretty strong. It is. So is Lutheranism. Lutheranism got so strong you had a division. You've got the Missouri Synod and wherever the other synod comes from now. That came about because of a division, a split in doctrine. You've got a division, I guess the Mormons are even set up similar to that. You've got a division among the Mormons. And you've got a hierarchy set up there, and they govern the affairs of the church. And if you're a member of the church, you are obliged to believe what you're told. Now, I realize they wouldn't say it in those words, but you find an easier way to say it. You're obliged to believe what the hierarchy says. The hierarchy places the church, places in the church the rulers of the church on a local level. The hierarchy will place a preacher or a priest or a rabbi or whatever it might be. They'll place that individual in that church or that parish or that diocese, and when they're ready to move him, they'll move him. And they'll do what they want. And that's the system that was established in the Massachusetts colony. Now, the problem with that is this. Your hierarchy is halfway around the world. And not only that, but your hierarchy is upset with the Puritan movement in general. In other words, the Puritans were trying to change the system. Remember when Vaughan was elected as the bishop there, the Archbishop of Canterbury, wherever it was, under Charles? The first thing he did was to label all of the clergymen in England as to whether they were Orthodox or Puritan, and indicated that the Puritans were not to receive any type of promotions, they were not to receive any type of recommendations to good positions, they were to be persecuted. As a matter of fact, in 1625, the persecution began in earnest. But we're dealing now back much earlier, 1635, we're dealing much earlier than that now. These Puritans had come to America foreseeing that there was going to be trouble. The Pilgrims already knew what trouble was. They knew what persecution was all about. They had already lost their homes and their lands. They had already lost their right to vote because of separation from the Anglican Church. They understood persecution. The Puritans didn't. The Puritans jumped ahead of things. Now, in a lot of ways, their wisdom is going to save this country from some problems. And as a matter of fact, the Puritans probably kept this nation from becoming anti-other religions. Okay? As a matter of fact, if it had been left up to the Pilgrims, there never would have been an Anglican got into this country. They were that much upset with what had gone on over there. But when the Puritans came into this country and settled in Massachusetts, they brought with them a desire to continue that old church-state existence and run their churches as they had always run their churches. But they run into a problem because now they can't get the hierarchy to work with them. How can you be, in other words, if you represented this morning a group of Lutherans or a group of Catholics who had broke with the Catholic Church and said, hey, you know, the Pope's full of beans and all that kind of stuff, and the Pope had excommunicated every one of you, you reckon if you wrote to the Vatican and asked them for a new priest, they'd send you one? That's the problem the Puritans are facing. They're on the outs with the hierarchy. Now, remember, in the first year of the establishment of this colony, they had some problems. And unlike all the other colonies that had gone before, their problems consisted of a general sickness. And in 1628, Endicott had come. They had had a general sickness, which seems to be the rule of almost everybody coming from Europe to America for about the first 100 years of the existence of this nation. They just got deathly sick. And whether it was the voyage over or the change in climate or whatever it was, it's hard to understand, but it just happened on a common basis. And when Endicott had problems, he didn't have a doctor. He brought 66 men with him. They established the colony. They started dying. He didn't have a doctor. So he sent down to... It would be nice if I had a pen. You got a pen? I just need one to point with. You can't take any notes. You can take notes anyway, right? You remember all this in your head. Endicott, up here at Salem, where his colony had been established, well, I better look here, went down here to Plymouth, about 40 miles distance, where the Pilgrims had been established. And again, this little area here surrounded was where the Pilgrims and that first colony had begun. And he sent down there and got a fellow by the name of Fuller. Fuller was the surgeon. He was the doctor for the Plymouth colony down there. And he came back to help Endicott with the fellows that were sick. Now, there are two diverse ideologies here. Remember, the Puritans were people that wanted to purify the system, and the Separatists were people that did what with the system? They junked it. And while they were there, Fuller had such a profound influence on Endicott that he basically solved that problem for them. Matter of fact, he had such an influence that Endicott said he never knew a more godly man in his whole life, a more peace-loving man. As a matter of fact, he named the name of his colony there Salem, which is Hebrew for peace. And largely because of the influence of Fuller did that colony receive that name right there in Massachusetts. But Fuller began to tell him the way the Puritans did things. And the Puritans had what was called a congregational system of operation. In other words, the congregation decided and voted and elected who their pastor was to be. They made that decision. They called their pastor. They asked him to come. And that's called a congregational form of worship. It's actually an early form of democracy. The people were allowed to vote and to decide who their leaders and who their leadership was to be. And because Massachusetts had no other means by which to govern their churches, they adopted that form of government. They became Congregationalists. And the Congregationalists then were allowed to elect their own preachers. They were allowed to elect their own leadership. They didn't need to go to a hierarchy. They didn't need to write back to the Vatican or to London. They didn't need to say, would it be all right if we had this guy? And they also didn't have to worry about those hierarchies pulling their leaders away from them. And so a congregational form of government was established. You say, why is that important? Because when your national government is put in place, it is this congregational form of church government that determines what type of national government that you have right now. You think about it for a minute. Isn't it amazing that people in this country want the right to vote on their own laws and elected officials and yet attend a church where they can't? What could be more un-American than that? What could undermine the American way of life more than that? It was the congregational form of government. Remember, there is no such thing as a representative democracy anywhere in the world at this time. It doesn't exist. There's no nation all the way around the world where the people cast a ballot and elect their leaders. Nowhere. Well, where do we come up with that idea? You know, you figure there were other nations at this time in the history of the world that were having revolutions. France had one, Italy had a revolution about the same time that America had one, and yet each of those nations have been through a multitude of other forms of government since then. I think I told you when we came through there, Italy, I believe, had 51 changes in the structure of their government in the same time that America has existed with one structure of government. Now, you want to explain that? Where did they get that from? I'll tell you where they got it from. They got it from men like John Locke. They got it from men like Charles Montesquieu. But they got it from watching church government in action in a democratic form in this country. Now then, these colonies were established. The only problem that continues to plague the Massachusetts colony, remember, John Winthrop comes in 1630, and Winthrop, if you read his writings, was a very, very, very godly man. And Winthrop and the Puritans, in contrast to the Pilgrims, had an intent to establish something in this country. The Pilgrims were just, we would call them today, I don't know what we would call them today. What do you call those people just pack up and leave and want to get away from it all? What is that? No, they just want to get away from society in general. We got a word for it. Survivalists, how about that? You know, we got them guys today, they pack up, they buy a tent, they move 200 miles off into the wilderness and buy a 2 month supply of food and, you know, walk around like Rambo and Toto, you know. The Pilgrims, by and large, that's where they were. They just wanted to survive. They didn't have any desire necessarily to establish a nation over here or to establish anything that was similar to a country. But when the Puritans came, they had enough money, they were much more educated, much smarter, and when they came, their intent was to establish a colony or, and again, a colony in the eyes of England then would have been a great huge colony. They had an intent of establishing something here that would last and endure. And as they did, they set to work. The problem that existed was that, again, in contrast to the Pilgrims, the Puritans believed in connection between church and state. Remember, they're trying to reform what system? The Anglican system. The Anglican system was an offshoot of what system? The papacy. And so it was just a continuation of that hierarchy and control. And while they adopted a congregational form of government in their churches, it was because they had no choice. But still, they continued that link between church and state. Let me give you some ideas of how things were established here. In order to vote, 1630 in the Massachusetts colony, you see, you were allowed to vote. And you were allowed to elect your own religious leaders, but when it came to the civil government, which is not the church government, but the general government of the Commonwealth, you had to be a voter. And in order to be a voter, you had to be a shareholder. And in order to be a shareholder, you had to be a freeman. So only the freemen were allowed to vote in this country. And in the first original colony, there were, I think, scarcely 30 of those freemen in the original colony. And by the time they first experienced problems with it, they had over 100 freemen, but the largest percentage of the population were not permitted to vote. You had to be a freeman, you had to be a shareholder in order to vote. And those individuals together comprised what was called the general court. And there was no House of Representatives, there was no Congress, there was none of that stuff. They comprised what was called a general court. And that general court voted on the laws that were to govern the colony. They voted on and elected the leaders that were to govern the colony. They had all the power in existence right there in their hands, just a very few type of individuals. And the interesting thing is that in order to be a freeman, you had to be a member of the church, which was the Puritan church. Now, while it was congregational, the Puritans were electing their own leaders in order to be able to vote on the civil side. In order to vote in the general court, you had to be, by law, a member of the church. You say, well, that don't sound like a half bad idea. It really doesn't to me. However, I can see the problems with that. Because you're going to deny a large segment of the voting population a right to vote. You're going to take away their liberty. That's one of the reasons I'm so proud to be a Baptist. Listen, the Baptists believed in separation of church and state before there ever were any pilgrims. That's the reason the Baptists were persecuted in Europe. You see, the pilgrims came over here. They ran and came over here and established a system, and they didn't believe in church and state being connected. While back in England, back in London, back in Paris, back in Bohemia, back in those countries over there, what few Baptists remained alive adamantly rejected the idea of a church-controlled state, and they were persecuted for it. So people say, why are you a Baptist? Because of my heritage. I'm opposed to church and state connections. I don't want a church state like they have in Mexico, like they have in El Salvador, like they have in Europe. I don't want that. I don't want the system Brother Bailey's in right now, Eastern Orthodox, where if you get caught passing out a tract, you can be deported out of the country. They established their colony here. They established a system where although they give the control of the church to the congregation itself, they do not give control of the civil government to the people. But that is still held in a church system. Now, it's interesting to watch this cycle go, because in order to vote for the civil authorities, you had to be a member of the church. And these churches, although they were congregational, and although they represented themselves, they would be what we call independents. These independents had kind of a written or an unwritten code of ethics and law that they subscribed to. And if your church didn't subscribe to these written or unwritten code of ethics, the other churches would kind of kick you out of the fellowship, so to speak. And really, to be honest with you, that's right where the independents are today. The independent Baptists in this country today have a little written independent Baptist handbook, and if you don't agree with that independent Baptist handbook, you're out the door. And yet we're all independents, mind you. It's very interesting to me, and I don't mean to sound bitter. I'm not bitter with individuals. I'm bitter with the system. I'm independent of the independents. I was at a meeting just several weeks ago where they had two or three great fundamentalist leaders. I'm going to tell you something right now. I know those men. And I know those men gained most of their reputation because they ran with the right people. That's where they got their reputation from. And in this nation, I know some other preachers that are some of the best preachers in this nation, and they believe exactly the same thing that those men I heard preach believe. But if they were to have them, those other men in their pulpit, they'd be disbarred. There's a little idea of fundamentalism. I'm an independent. Last year at our Bible conference, we had fellows preach in our pulpit that came from 9 different seminaries. I guarantee you're not going to find that in their churches. Our church supports right around 70-some-odd missionaries. We support missionaries from probably no less than, I would guess, 15 to 20 mission boards. You're not going to find that in their churches. They're not independents. They have a name, but they're not independents. Now, these pilgrims down here, they were independents. They believed in the separation of church and state, but the Puritans didn't. So, in order to be a voter, you had to be a member of a church to vote on the elected officials. And the churches controlled what other churches were accepted in that little fellowship of independent churches. And if you wanted to establish another church, guess how you did that? The only churches that could be established were churches that were recognized by the civil magistrates. Now you see the tie? The churches, you have to be a member of the church in order to vote for the civil magistrate. The civil magistrate determines who can set up churches. See how it works? That's called a church state, and that's exactly what you're headed for in this nation. And that's exactly what you got in Europe. That's exactly what you got in Mexico. That's exactly... Listen, the greatest enemy this country ever had, and I don't mean to offend anybody, it's not my intent, the greatest enemy that liberty ever had was the Vatican. You say, and I told you when I started, you have to look hard and heavy to find me hating anybody that's a Catholic. I don't hate Catholic people. I believe in religious liberty, but I despise the Vatican. You say, why? Go to Mexico. Go to Costa Rica. Go to Cuba. Castro's always been a member of the church. Still in good standing. He's a member of the same church Adolf Hitler was a member of. Never excommunicated. Goering, Goebbels, Himmler, Heinrich, all members of the same church. Never excommunicated. Interesting thought. You say, why are you so dead set against it? Because once, and I'll be honest with you, if the Baptists, you say, well, why are you not opposed to the Baptists? Baptists never tried to gain control of the government. I don't want to gain control of the government. I'm as opposed to the Baptists running this country as I am the Vatican. I don't want any church to control the government. And if I sound hard against the Vatican, that's because the Baptist doesn't have a civil government set up, doesn't have a political tie with other countries. The Baptist Church doesn't have an ambassador to it. There's an ambassador from the United States in the Vatican right now, recognizing it as a political power. I'm opposed to that. I'll die opposed to that. I'll fight against that. You say, why? I'm a Baptist. I'm crazy. But the Puritans now are kind of a combination because they've adopted some of the ideologies of the Pilgrims, but others they've kept in Anglican form, and now they've got this little catch-all that always exists in any church state. For instance, in Mexico, supposedly you have freedom of religion unless you're an evangelical. What is an evangelical? An evangelical is anybody that teaches you don't have to take mass to go to heaven. If you're an evangelical in Mexico now, you cannot get a permanent residency visa. So I don't believe that. I got about 25 friends down there, have to come out of the country. They pastor churches. They work with people down there. They feed people. They run orphanages. And they have to come out once a month or once every 6 weeks to get a new visa to go back in the country. Why? Because they threaten the government. How can you threaten the government if you're running an orphanage feeding children? It's not what they're doing, it's what they represent. You know, Mexico has free elections. They get to vote for the president. You get to elect their president. But if you want to run for the president, you have to be a member of one church. You cannot run for president if you are not a member of the one church. You say, that's not democracy. That's a dictatorship. That is a dictatorship, and the dictator is a church. That's what almost is established in Massachusetts. You have to be a member of the church. The church then can elect the magistrate, but then the magistrate determines who gets to start the church. And the church also has the ability to exclude other churches if they don't follow the guidelines that the church sets up. So you, in essence, have a church-controlled state. Now, you say, why is that important? Because when our Constitution is founded, the Massachusetts form of government was almost adopted on a national level. You came that close to having the Massachusetts form of government adopted on a national level, with the congregational form of government adopted into the United States of America. And I mean that close. Were it not for a group of people we're going to talk about in just a minute, you today would have been paying taxes to support the Anglican or the American Anglican Church. You today would, and you now are still paying taxes to support parochial schools all over the state of Ohio, which is another thing. But you would still, to this day, be recognized as a church only if the state recognized you as a church and said you could exist as a church. And if they didn't say you could exist as a church, then you couldn't exist as a church, and you couldn't vote in an election unless you were a member of the church. You see how things cut out? Now, what takes place? Now, don't get me wrong. These people in Massachusetts were people just like you that loved the Lord. See, sometimes when you talk about churches, people think you mean people. When I talk about the Vatican and the papacy, I'm not talking about Catholic people. I find Catholic people, most cases, are just as decent and respectable as you and I are. But I'll tell you what you find. These people in Massachusetts were good people. They loved the Lord. As a matter of fact, you read some of their writings about their love for the Lord, and it put you and I to shame. These people were good, hard-working, industrious people that loved the Lord. And you know what they wanted? They wanted a country that was free from wickedness, that wickedness like they saw in England couldn't gain hold of. They wanted, all they knew over there was that they had seen a system in Rome that had killed millions and millions of people, and they didn't want that here. So what they did is they went in the other ditch. They said, well, we'll have an Anglican church here, and we won't allow those people in. I read to you the charters of Virginia. The first two or three charters forbid any papist from settling in Virginia. That's the kind of people they were. They said, no way. We are not going to let it in this country. But in so doing, you see what they're doing? They're establishing a system just like that. It wasn't the people that the papacy represented that made the system go bad. It was the system itself that made the system go bad. Absolute power does what? Corrupts absolutely. And when you put a church in control and set up a system like that, whether it be the papacy or whether it be these God-fearing people in Massachusetts, you're going to end up the same place every time. These people, John Locke talked about people who would come into a system, and they would come in as the underdog, so to speak. They would suffer persecution. They would suffer resentment and sometimes even physical torture. But they would continue, and they would win people to Christ. They would win people to God, and people would begin to get saved. And then before long, they were in a majority, and then they would turn around and make laws that said nobody else could come in who dissented from their viewpoints, and thereby cut off the same avenue by which they had gained control. And that's one of the things John Locke abhorred, was an establishment of a church state, which is exactly what happened in Massachusetts. A church state. Now then, they're hung. 1630, they set things up, begin to operate that way. They immediately have problems from the very onset. And the worries of men like Witherspoon and those men were, while we have a good system set up now, what happens in 20 years? What happens in 40 years? When we're gone, and when our children take our places, and our grandchildren take our places, and they don't have the insight that we had, They don't have the wisdom that we've had. They don't have the resources that we've had. What happens to our government then? You see, absolute power corrupts absolutely eventually. You're seeing the same thing in America now. You're having a generation take control of your government that never fought for it, never paid a dime for it, and they're ruining it left and right. That's what's going on. As a matter of fact, within 50 years, I'll read you a little bit probably next week about the condition of the Plymouth colony and how the governors, Bradford and those men that looked at the colony they had 50 years later wept because that their children hadn't gotten saved. Their children had been raised as people that were hungry for land and hungry for this new ability to set up your own house. They hungered and thirsted after freedom so much that they forgot God. One of them, I can't remember exactly what the quote was, but I'll quote it to you next week. Something about the effect that the church gave birth to liberty and the daughter devoured the mother. That's quite a quote, but that's what happened. You have some dissenters here. And those who dissented were dealt with harshly. But some fellows that they couldn't just exclude. One of them was a fellow by the name of Roger Williams. That's not the guy who plays the piano, all right? You need to remember the name of Roger Williams. Roger Williams was a Ruckmanite, I really believe. From reading after Rotten, nobody liked the guy. The guy was arrogant and cocky. I picture him as a Ruckmanite for some reason. You couldn't tell him he was wrong. He believed he was right and everybody else was wrong. Sound familiar? He probably was a member of our church, and we didn't even know it. But I read an account of one fellow yesterday, and he said he was God intoxicated. He said that all he lived for was to please God and to be pure in his sight. He had some strange ideas, particularly to these people who didn't have those things. You know, any idea that's against what you believe is a strange idea. And so oftentimes things are said and stated that probably ought not to have been said and stated, but it is the people who opposed you that are given the representation. Roger Williams came to this country and he settled there in the Massachusetts colony. He was a preacher. Remember, in this day and time, the most educated people in the town were preachers. I mean, you could be a farmer without going to school back then. You can't do that today. You can be a lot of things without going to school, but you couldn't be a clergyman without going to school. And the greatest schools in England were Cambridge, which was a place where they trained preachers. And sometimes in the early settlements, the preacher was the only fellow that could even read. Now that's why the church basically was involved in education. I mean, who's going to teach your kids if the preacher doesn't do it? The first schools in this country were church schools. The Ivy League schools, every one of them except one, was started as a seminary. Can you imagine Harvard and Yale being seminaries? That's where they were founded. That's their purpose. You go to Princeton University to this day and look on the inscription out there of what the founder of Princeton University desired for the students, and you'll laugh when you look at the student body on Princeton campus, founded as church schools. The preacher was the most educated. I mean, you know, that's probably true today, too. Sure, probably true. I'd be a fool to deny that, wouldn't I? But the most educated man far and away then was the preacher. And because of that, the people relied on him to not only teach them, but to give them information. He was the one, when they'd get a letter, he'd have to read it. When they would, when a government decision was made in England, he'd have to interpret it for the people and explain to them what it meant because he had the education to do so. And because of that, they looked up to him, and clergymen were a respected commodity in the early colonies. And when Roger Williams came to this country, he came as a respected clergyman. And the only problem was that when he got here, he just seemed to have, you know, he had a bone to pick with somebody. He was one of those fellows that just never kind of seemed to fit in anywhere. And he went to the Plymouth colony, and as a matter of fact, one of the few friends that he had all through his life was Witherspoon, who was the governor of the colony in Massachusetts. Witherspoon loved him. He was a good man. You'll find Witherspoon saying a lot of good things about him, although his arrogancy and his determination that everybody else was, he's kind of a reactionary, cost him. As a matter of fact, he is so upset with Massachusetts because they will not break with the King of England. He is upset with that. And he believes that the church and the state ought to be separate, and he's upset because these Puritans here have not broken all ties with the Anglican church. He said, you're over here, you've got your own form of government, you've got a church state established over here, you've got your people electing their own religious leaders over here. Why continue to bow and kneel before the English crown? He's all upset. And, of course, that's not received real well. Here's a young colony struggling for its existence. All they need are 10,000 British troops to arrive tomorrow to take care of one guy. And so Williams is kind of shunned. And because he's shunned, he leaves and he moves down to the Plymouth colony. And he's loved in Plymouth. William Bradford spoke very highly of him. He suspected him because of the fact that Roger Williams was very quick in his study of the Scriptures when he found some new doctrine to believe that everybody had to believe it or else they were all damned. You know, is that kind of an idea? It sounded like a Rockmanite, I'm telling you. It just seems like the way they are. And he believed whenever he, and a lot of times even without thinking, he'd establish some new thought. Now, let me say this in his behalf. He stayed in the Bible, he read the Bible, and he believed what he read. So much so that he was willing to make a radical departure. If he was here today and read something in the Scriptures that contradicted where he was, tomorrow he'd be over here. Just as dogmatic over here as he was over there. And you say, well, that's kind of stupid. No, that's what this country needs more of. I'd 10 times rather argue with a fellow that believed he was right and I was wrong than to argue with one of these mushy guys and believe, well, you know, none of us are really right and none of us are really wrong and a little good and all is a little bad. Just get out of my sight. You can't establish anything with a guy like that. I mean, if you believe something, believe it's right. And if somebody shows you that it's wrong, believe what is right. There needs to be a seeking after the truth in this country, and we've lost it. Well, you know, we just need to all get along. And since when does the truth have to get along with a lie? You say, well, how do you know you're right? Show me I'm wrong, and I'll side with you. I want to be right. He leaves and goes down to Plymouth, and while he's down in Plymouth, and of course, remember, the Pilgrims believe in the separation of church and state, so it seemed like he's right at home. But when he got down to Plymouth, lo and behold, he's received and recognized. It's not long before he's teaching in the churches there. And a very, very educated, very devout man, he's doing some good for the Plymouth colony, and lo and behold, one day, guess what he finds out? He finds out that the Pilgrim representatives in England, those who are representing their colony, remember they're still relying on English goods to get to the colony. So they've got some representatives in London. And he finds out that those representatives have committed the unpardonable sin. They have gone to an Anglican church. And the man explodes. He says, how in the world can this colony, who have left the Anglican Church, have representatives representing us in England, buying our food and supplies, who are going to Anglican churches? And he says, bless God, it's time we broke all ties with them. Well, now, he's an outsider. Respected and loved as he may be, but those people in England are the ones that supplying the food and the tools and the clothing. And it's not long before he has to say bye-bye to the Plymouth colony because of his stand against wickedness anywhere he saw it. As a matter of fact, one fellow went so far as to say that by the time it was all done, the only fellow that he found pure enough to take communion with was his wife. And after a while, he wouldn't even take it with her. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily true, but that gives you an idea of how this fellow was with wickedness. He just couldn't tolerate it anywhere. And I'm sad to say, you have to learn to tolerate wickedness. That doesn't mean you don't have to, you have to love it. You can still hate it, but you're going to have to tolerate it. And Williams had a problem tolerating it anywhere. So he goes back up to Massachusetts, and they take him into the Salem Church. He becomes a pastor of the Salem Church, and it's not long till he's back at it again. As a matter of fact, he's back at these Puritans. He comes to the point where he says, you know, this colony needs to repent of ever having been Anglican in the first place. And bless God, if you're not willing to get on your face and weep and cry to God and apologize for being an Anglican in the first place, you ought to be excommunicated. Well, here you go again. And Witherspoon eventually took him to civil court. Now then, see, here's the problem. When you combine church and state, here's the problem you get into. You remove the ability of the church to govern itself. And you also give to the government the right to judge cases of morality and ethics. Now, that's fine as long as, like you had here in the Massachusetts colony, the religious leaders were in charge of the government. And those religious leaders had not themselves yet become corrupt. But eventually, that system will corrupt itself. And so all at once, you have a government. When you got a problem with a clergyman, you know what you do? You go down here and get the mayor, and you have him arrested, and you put him in jail, and you try him in a court, and you kick him out of the colony. That's never been the right of the civil government. The civil government has no jurisdiction whatsoever in the church. The church controls itself. You have problems with the pastor here, you vote. If you have problems with the pastor that goes into heresy, there's a method by which you take care of that. It's not the government's job. You say, why? What's wrong with that? Look at where America is right now. The country for the last 20 years has been seizing control of the church. And right now the church is beginning to dictate for the first time in the history, the government, is beginning to dictate to the church what they can and cannot preach. You say, where are we? You're right back in England or the Vatican. You're going right back to that church-state system. Right now, you see what happens is when homosexuality becomes a problem, you make it a civil matter. See, these homosexuals have rights, civil rights. And so when a preacher gets up and preaches against queers, he's violating their civil rights. Therefore, a preacher can no longer preach against queers because he can't violate their civil rights. You say, well, the Bible be hanged. That's the opinion of your government. That's what happens. Now, you say, well, that's terrible. Yeah, but it would have happened 150 years ago had not been for the separation of church and state. The problem with this country is in 1962 it redefined the issue of separation of church and state and destroyed what our forefathers intended and implemented their own ideology that has been resulted in less than 25 years in what you got right now. In 1962, in essence, the government said, in order to maintain the separation between church and state, we're going to control the church. That's exactly what they did in 1962. Up to that point, it had been an entirely different setup. And so your government now is beginning to control the state. Williams had a hard time. Finally, in 1635, he is banished from the colony. Now, I will say that Endicott and these individuals still loved Williams. Matter of fact, Endicott kept up correspondence with him until the day that he died. Continued to write and befriend him. But he was banished from the Massachusetts colony. He flees southward and establishes a colony down here at Rhode Island. Now, it's interesting to watch Williams, as he grows older, change his views. Now, that's the wonderful thing about a pursuit of the truth. You know, you get real angry with a fellow and say, well, he's obstinate and obnoxious and he believes he's right and everybody else is wrong. But if that fellow continues that way, those wrong views will amend themselves in time. There needs to be a wholehearted submission to the truth and a following after the truth. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness. Why? Because they're good people? No, for they shall be filled. And Williams changes a whole lot of his viewpoints from the time he was preaching down here in Plymouth and Massachusetts until the time that he dies. As a matter of fact, they say that by the time Williams, matter of fact, what happened is Williams got down here and established his own colony, and he ran into the same problems that they were having in Massachusetts, and the only way to solve them was to do the same thing they're doing in Massachusetts. So he became guilty of doing some of the same things he was blasting them for back in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. For instance, he said, you have no reason to go and get a charter from the King of England to the Massachusetts. But when he established his Rhode Island, guess what he did? He had to go get a charter from the King of England to establish his colony. When he got there, because of his reactionary radical stand, every crackpot wanting to come to America came to Rhode Island. I mean, if they didn't like the rules imposed by the Massachusetts Bay or the Plymouth colony, they came to Rhode Island, and he had his hands full. I mean, he got some wingdings. One of the major problems he had was with the Quakers. Now, I know how you people always say, well, who in the world could ever have trouble with Quakers? Those peace-loving people, those people that refuse even to go to war, you don't know much about their early history. They didn't become peace-loving people that were opposed to war until about the time this country finished its revolution. You need to go back and read some pre-revolutionary history of the Quakers. They were about as radical of people as you have ever seen. They didn't think twice about coming in and disrupting church services with hollering and screaming. They were just radicals. So much so that they were outlawed in Massachusetts. They didn't even want the people living there. They said, get out of here. They had people, everywhere they went, they tried to destroy. They had a persecution complex. They believed that the way to get close to God, remember Fox's Book of Martyrs? Fox wrote about all the martyrs. They had this idea that if you wanted to get close to God, you had to be persecuted. And how better to be persecuted than to cause problems in churches and in governments? And they went after it. I mean, they did everything in the world they could to antagonize. Poor old Williams is down here, and he's been telling everybody that the government shouldn't have right to oversee the affairs of the church, and now he's having to deal with these Quakers. And Williams, because God dealt with him so much, has to amend some of his viewpoints. And those that knew him closest said he came to a point where he broke. And from that point, rather than being so obnoxious and hateful, he became one of the most loving and endearing men that they ever knew in their life. He changed just like that. And spent actually most of the latter parts of his life showing why he was wrong in some of the views he espoused while he was younger. But always loving God and always loving purity. The Baptists found a home down there with Williams. The Baptists were not appreciated in Massachusetts because of their strong stand for the separation of church and state. As a matter of fact, they weren't even appreciated in Plymouth very much, although Plymouth basically had such a loving, kind disposition as a colony, they didn't throw anybody out other than the Quakers. Nobody got along with the Quakers. But most of the Baptists settled up around where Williams was up there, because he, in essence, began to espouse the same things they had believed all their lives. And that was that the government had no right to interfere with the functioning of a church. And conversely, that the church had no right to seize control of the government to provide for its own ends. And that's the viewpoint now that begins to grow up in Rhode Island. We got to quit. Next week, I'm going to show you another fellow that went down into Connecticut. His name is Thomas Hooker. And Thomas Hooker went down and began to banish the notion that only freemen and church members should be able to vote. And you're going to find that God moves a little bit south and begins to establish two ideals that will build this country when it's finally established. All right, let's take a break this morning.